tried to break a spaghetti in half and failed. Some of the same experiments tried it about 12 years ago and couldn't come up with much of anything. So I don't know. The twist seems to be reasonably easy to do. They did it repeatedly, and they even automated the process. So it's not as difficult as it sounds to just give a piece of spaghetti a bit of a twist.
Is there a simple explanation for why the twist solves the problem, so to speak?
Tend to be theorizing, at least for the lay public who gets headaches with the equation. It is that in some way the twist dampens the transmission of the shock wave that usually runs out from the central area of other pieces of the spaghetti and allows it to stay localized in the center where it could just snap cleanly in half.
WHOSA White. I wonder how this applies to a handful of 2 ounces of spaghetti that you want to cook separate. I don't think you want to twist every one of them one by hand.
But you're not really, are you that really interested in getting an even split in half? Mind if they break into thirds, right?
You've probably done this, Doug. If you hold if your left hand and your right hand are close enough together and you're trying to break the spaghetti in the middle, I think you get a cleaner break where your hands are close enough together and your hands are acting as a damping structure. W2SAY, K2IW.
Interesting idea, Dick. I thought about that. Although I think my hands are usually fairly close together, but maybe not close enough. W2SAY, out listening.
And you'd probably get different results if your hands were wet. Back to you, Roy.
W2RY.
David.
Just yesterday I made some spaghetti, and I just broke it in half, and I didn't think about anything.
But if your pieces that broke in half really were breaking into thirds, a few of them were doing that, would you know the difference? That's David. Go ahead, David.
I don't know. I mean, I've never broken them into thirds, only into half. So, you know, when Roy brings up the subject, you know, it's all new to me.
Yeah, the experiment they were doing is to take a piece of spaghetti and just as if you had an index finger on each end, and you're bringing your index fingers together, you're bending the spaghetti into one great big loop. Under that condition, you don't get a clean break. You get a whole lot of breaks. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, exactly, Dick. If you obviously take your two fingers and put it a quarter of an inch away from the central area of the spaghetti and apply force, there's going to be very little shockwave propagation. This is for the experiment that you grab onto the edges of a normal-sized piece of dry spaghetti and bend it over in half and try and have it snap in half, and repeatedly you will get three pieces, four pieces, you will get five pieces, but it would be incredibly unusual to get two pieces. But now we know that if we twist it, we get two pieces, if anyone's interested.
I'll bet you it's kind of difficult with your fingers to do that twist. A very dry piece of spaghetti, I think it would take a lot of force to twist it to 270 degrees.
I say I've never tried, but I guess the next time I'm near spaghetti, I'm going to ruin pieces of it. Just trying to. Okay, on to the next. Imagine traveling to the moon in just 20 seconds. That's how fast material from a 170-year-old stellar eruption sped away from the unstable, eruptive, and extremely massive star known as Eta Carinae. Astronomers have concluded that this is the fastest jettisoned gas ever measured from a stellar outburst that didn't result in the complete annihilation of that star. The blast from the most luminous star known in our galaxy released almost as much energy as a typical supernova explosion that would have left behind a stellar corpse. However, in this case, a double star system remained and played a critical role in the circumstances that led to the colossal blast. Let me drop.
Once again, they went to Earth to Moon that distance in what fraction of time? If it did it in less than 1.25 seconds, then it's exceeding the speed of light. So go ahead.
Didn't violate good old Albert Einstein. It took it 20 seconds.
Okay, no problem.
Light echoes usually occur when the light from a bright, short-lived event are reflected off of clouds of dust, which act like distant mirrors, redirecting light in our direction. Like an audio echo, the arriving signal of the reflected light has a time delay after the original event due to the finite speed of light. In the case of Eta Carinae, the bright event was a major eruption of the star that expelled a huge amount of mass back in the mid-1800s during what is known as the Great Eruption. The delayed signal of these light echoes allowed astronomers to decode the light from that eruption with modern astronomical telescopes and instruments, even though the original eruption was first seen from Earth back in the mid-19th century. That was a time before modern tools like the astronomical spectrograph were even invented. Let me drop. A light echo is the next best thing to time travel, a researcher said. That's why light echoes are so beautiful. They give us a chance to unwrap the mysteries of a rare stellar eruption that was witnessed 100 years ago, but using our modern telescopes and cameras, we can also compare that information about the event itself with a 170-year-old remnant nebula that was ejected. This was a behemoth stellar explosion from a very rare monster star, the likes of which have not happened since in our Milky Way galaxy. Let me drop.
Star just dropped about 6 dB.
Yeah, my amplifier isn't kind of playing this time it's having. It, you know, it's warming up, I think.
Sounds like it needs a bigger fan, Roy.
Yeah, I gotta get it a fan now. Okay. Can I continue?
You sure can. It has cycled back. I think it's going into a self-protect mode when it goes to over temperature.
Hopefully that's exactly what it's doing. Let me drop the power a bit and you can tell me if it's impacting on my signal.
Roger.
Okay, how about now? Is the signal still decent?
Signal is very decent right now. Please proceed. By the way, when we were doing testing for your dropouts, your momentary dropouts, I think you used more than one completely different transmitter, and you still had it, which is really strange. If it was a funniness of your particular transmitter, it's hard for me to believe that two separate transmitters of two different brand names or model numbers would both do that. Over to you, Roy.
As I remember it, I tried different antennas, but I kept the same radio. So it may be something strange about my Flex radio. And unfortunately, the Flex isn't really designed for 2 meters. I'm kind of forcing it to do that. So there's an extra module from Down East Microwave that I plug into the back. So unfortunately, there's more than one possible reason for failure on the radio end. But I really, really like using my 67,000. I have an ICOM 7100 that if all else fails, I'll just fall back to it. But I really like my Flex.
By the way, he's putting out about the same amount of signal strength as he was before.
How about that?
Okay, my power meter says lower, but okay. Great eruption temporarily promoted Eta Carinae to the second brightest star visible in our nighttime sky, vastly outshining the energy output of every other star in the Milky Way. after which the star faded from the naked eye. The outburst expelled material about 10 times more than the mass of our own sun. It was also formed with bright, glowing gas clouds known as the homunculus. This dumbbell-shaped remnant is visible surrounding... it's beeping again. Let me lower it again.
Do you hear me now?
I heard the word, do we hear me now? For the previous 45 seconds, we heard nothing.
Now he's putting out more signal than you, Dick.
Okay, I fell back to my 7100. How's this?
Sounding awful good. So that's a separate radio. That's a different radio. Let's see if that has dropouts.
Okay, very good. Anyway, the eruptive remnant can even be seen in small amateur telescopes from the Earth's southern hemisphere and equatorial regions, but it's best seen in images obtained with the Hubble Space Telescope. The team used instruments on the 8-meter Gemini South Telescope, the Ciro Tolo Inter-American Observatory 4-meter Blanco Telescope, and the Magellan Telescope at Las Campanas Observatory to decode the light from these light echoes and to understand the expansion speeds in the historical explosion. Gemini spectroscopy helped pin down the unprecedented velocity we observed in this gas, which clocked in at between about 10,000 to 20,000 kilometers per second, according to researchers. Let me drop.
I got a comment.
Okay, comment away, Eric.
Not only are you putting in more signal into the repeater now, but the actual output is cleaner. Whereas on the flex radio, I see it wiggle up and down a little bit. I was kind of considering maybe that was conditions, but now I'm definitely thinking that radio's got a problem because this one's fine. There hasn't been a dropout. I think you can go for the rest of the night without a dropout. But it really, the signal itself doesn't have the artifacts that I'm seeing on the other radio. So there you go.
Okay, so the 7100 I shall use.
All right. One comment I want to make to you is that when you run your other nets and all the repeaters that you don't have a problem with, maybe, you know, even if you put out a watt, you still do great into those other repeaters because they're closer to you. Just a thought.
Okay, Doc. Anyway, getting back. We see these really high velocities all the time in supernova explosions where the star is obliterated, researchers noted. However, in this case, the star survived, and explaining that led the researchers into new territory. Something must have dumped a lot of energy into the star in a short amount of time. The material expelled by Eta Carinae is traveling up to 20 times faster than expected for typical winds from a massive star. So, according to researchers, enlisting the help of two partner stars might explain the extreme outflow. The researchers suggest that the most straightforward way to simultaneously explain a wide range of observed facts surrounding the eruption and the remnant star system seen today is with an interaction of three stars, including a dramatic event where two of the three stars merge into one monster star. Let me drop. If that's the case, then the present-day binary system must have started out as a triple system, with one of those two stars being the one that swallowed its sibling. Eta Carinae is an unstable type of star known as a luminous blue variable, located about 7,500 light-years from Earth in a young star-forming nebula found in the southern constellation of Carinae. The star is one of the intrinsically brightest in our galaxy and shines some 5 million times brighter than our sun, with a mass about 100 times greater. Stars like Eta Carinae have the greatest mass loss rates prior to undergoing supernova explosions, but the amount of mass expelled by Eta Carinae's 19th century great eruption exceeds any other known. Let me drop. Etikrin I will probably undergo a true supernova explosion sometime within the next 500,000 years at most, but possibly much sooner. Some types of supernova have been seen to experience eruptive blasts like this of Etikrin I only a few years or decades before their final explosion. So some astronomers speculate that Etikrin I might blow sooner than later. The Gemini observations utilized the Gemini multi-object spectrogram on the Gemini South Telescope in Chile and used a powerful technique called nod and shuffle that enables greatly improved spectroscopic measurements of extremely faint sources by reducing the contaminating effects of the night sky. The new results are presented in two papers published in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomy Society. Let me drop for any questions or comments.
Don't have a problem. By the way, Dick, I turned off the motor because it actually enhances the problem. It wants to switch over. At least now he's being picked up by the hospital where he wasn't before, so there's still an issue.
Okay, so this is a separate radio with a separate antenna with separate cables, so I the only thing is the same is the location.
Well, that's entirely possible. Although I gotta say, with this radio, I think it's putting out a little more power than the other one is, and it's less of an issue. And then when I turn the motor off, then you barely hear it, but you hear your audio dip for a moment.
Okay, so we still have a mystery.
I tell you, I'm sorry to keep interrupting you.
It's quite okay. Next on our list is Fermi Labs Accelerator Complex has achieved a major milestone. The U.S. Department of Energy formally approved Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory to proceed with its design of the Proton Improvement Plan Mark II, an accelerator upgrade project that will provide increased beam power to generate an unprecedented stream of neutrinos, subatomic particles that could unlock our understanding of the universe and enable a broad program of physics research for many years to come. The Proton Improvement Plan 2 accelerator upgrades are integral to the Fermilab-hosted Deep Underground Neutrino Experiment, which is the largest international space experiment ever to be conducted on U.S. soil. The Deep Underground Neutrino Experiment requires enormous quantities of neutrinos to study the mysterious particles in detail, and with the latest improvements of the Proton Improvement Plan 2, Fermilab is positioned to be the world leader in accelerator-based neutrino research. The Long Baseline Neutrino Facility, which will also support the Deep Underground Neutrino Experiment, had its groundbreaking ceremony in July of 2017. Let me drop. The opportunity to contribute to the Proton Improvement Plan 2 has drawn scientists and engineers from around the world to Fermilab. The Proton Improvement Plan 2 is the first accelerator project on U.S. soil that will have significant contributions from international partners. Fermilab's Proton Improvement Plan 2 partnership includes institutions in India, Italy, France, UK, as well as the United States. The Proton Improvement Plan 2 capitalizes on recent particle accelerator advances developed at Fermilab and other institutions that will allow its accelerators to generate particle beams at higher power than previously available. The high-power particle beams will in turn create intense neutrino beams, providing scientists with an abundance of these subtle particles. Let me drop. We have discussed neutrinos more than a few times here. Neutrinos are ubiquitous yet fleeting particles, the most difficult to capture of all the members of the subatomic particle family. Scientists capture them by sending neutrino beams generated from particle accelerators to large, stories-high detectors. The greater the number of neutrinos sent to the detector, the greater the chance of the detector catching them, and more opportunity there is to study these subatomic escape artists. Fermi's lab's upgraded Proton Improvement Plan 2 accelerator complex will generate proton beams of significantly greater power than currently available. The increase in beam power translates into more neutrinos that can be sent to the lab's various neutrino experiments. The result will be the world's most intense high-energy neutrino beam. Let me drop. The goal of the Proton Improvement Plan 2 is to produce a proton beam of more than 1 megawatt. That's about 60% higher than the existing accelerator complex supplies. Eventually, enabled by the Proton Improvement Plan 2, Fermilab could upgrade the accelerator to double that power, to more than 2 megawatts. The largest and most ambitious of these detectors are those in the Deep Underground Neutrino Experiment, which is scheduled to start up in mid-2020s. The Deep Underground Neutrino Experiment will use two detectors separated by a distance of 800 miles, one at Fermilab and a second, much larger detector situated 1 mile underground in South Dakota at the Stanford Underground Research Facility. Prototypes of this technology are under construction right now at the European Particle Physics Lab at CERN, which is a major partner in this long-term baseline neutrino facility / deep underground neutrino experiment. And they're expected to begin to take data later this year. Let me drop. Fermilab's accelerator, enhanced according to the Proton Improvement Plan 2, will send a beam of neutrinos to the Deep Underground Neutrino Experiment Detector at Fermilab. The beam will continue on its path straight through the Earth's crust to the detector in South Dakota. Scientists will study the data gathered by both detectors, comparing them to get a better handle on how neutrino properties change over the long distance. The detector, located in South Dakota, known as the Deep Underground Neutrino Experiment FAR detector, is enormous. It will stand 4 stories high and occupy an area equivalent to a soccer field. With its supporting platform, the Long Baseline Neutrino Facility, the Deep Underground Neutrino Experiment is designed to handle a neutrino deluge. Let me drop. The centerpiece of the Proton Improvement Plan 2 project is the construction of a new superconducting radio frequency linear accelerator, which will become the initial stage of the upgraded Fermilab accelerator chain. It will replace the current Fermilab linear accelerator. The plan is to install the superconducting radio frequency linear accelerator under 25 feet of dirt in the infield of the now decommissioned Tevatron ring. The new superconducting radio frequency linear accelerator will provide a big boost to its particle beams, doubling the beam energy of its predecessor from 400 million to 800 million electron volts. That boost will enable the Fermilab accelerator complex to achieve megawatt scale beam power. Let me drop. Superconducting materials carry zero electrical resistance, so current sails through them effortlessly. By taking advantage of superconducting components, accelerators minimize the amount of power they draw from the power grid, channeling more of it to the beam. Beams thus achieve higher energies at less cost than in normal conducting accelerators, such as Fermilab's current linear accelerator. In the linear accelerator, superconducting components called accelerating cavities will impart energies to particle beams. The cavities, which look like strands of jumbo silver pearls, are made of niobium and will be lined up end to end. The particle beam will accelerate down the axis of one cavity after another, picking up energy as it goes. It will resonate at 162 megahertz, then go to 325 megahertz. And then finally 650 megahertz, at which time it will have 800 million electron volts of energy. Let me drop. Many current and future particle accelerators are based on superconducting technology, and the advances that help scientists study neutrinos have multiplying effects outside fundamental science. Researchers are developing superconducting accelerators for medicine, environmental cleanup, quantum computing, industry, and national security. In the Proton Improvement Plan 2, a beam of protons will be injected into the linear accelerator. Over the course of its 578-foot length, the beam will accelerate to an energy of 800 million electron volts. Once it passes through the superconducting linear accelerator, it will enter the rest of Fermilab's current accelerator chain, a further three accelerators, which will also undergo significant upgrades over the next few years to handle the higher energy beam from the new linear accelerator. By the time the beam exits the final accelerator, it will have an energy of up to 120 billion electron volts and more than 1 megawatt of power. Let me drop. After the proton beam exits the chain, it will strike a segmented cylinder of carbon. The carbon beam collision will create a shower of other particles, which will be routed to various Fermilab experiments. Some of these post-collision particles will decay into neutrinos, which will be, by that point, already on the path towards their detectors. The Proton Improvement Plan 2 initial proton beam, which scientists will be able to distribute between the Long Baseline Neutrino Facility and other experiments, can be delivered in pulses or as a continuous proton stream. The front-end component for the Proton Improvement Plan 2, those upstream from the superconducting linear accelerator, are already developed and undergoing testing. Let me drop. Fermilab expects to complete the project by the mid-2020s, in time for the startup of the Long Baseline Neutrino Facility Deep Underground Neutrino Experiment. Let me drop for any questions or comments. Okay, on to the next one. You can feasibly put anything inside the world's largest physics experiment, CERN's Large Hadron Collider, in Switzerland, so long as it can be vaporized. Usually you put protons inside, but you can put anything in there. For the first time, scientists have accelerated an atomic nucleus with some of their electrons still attached. The Large Hadron Collider's goal, in short, is to bestow subatomic particles with energies otherwise unachievable on Earth, hoping to uncover the fundamental nature of the universe. The LHC typically accelerates protons, the positive pieces of atomic nuclei, or entire atomic nuclei. Usually, these nuclei have been stripped of their negatively charged electrons. But in this case, the beam of lead atoms, technically their ions, travel through the accelerator with at least one electron attached. The physicists hope to one day use these accelerated atoms in a next-generation experiment. Let me drop. The LHC typically starts with neutral lead atoms or a bottle of hydrogen gas, which travels through a chain of smaller particle accelerators. Oscillating magnetic fields strip many of the electrons from the lead atoms, but the atoms lose their remaining electrons when they pass through a metal foil before entering the 17-mile round ring. Researchers adjusted the width of the foil so that one electron remained attached to the lead atom. The scientists then adjusted the LHC to maintain the beam of particles with one more electron than the lead ion in the experiments usually have. The researchers were able to keep the beam circulating in the Large Hadron Collider for 2 hours, according to the release. Let me drop. Aside from being the first, the experiment is a proof of concept for a proposal that could potentially turn the LHC into a gamma ray factory. If realized, the LHC would produce the high-energy man-made electromagnetic waves ever. These electromagnetic waves could be turned into secondary beams for all sorts of research purposes, including the study of dark matter. It could open new research opportunities in a vast domain of uncharted fundamental physics and industrial application territories, according to the proposal. Such a gamma ray factory would involve hitting one of these single electron atom beams with a laser, causing the electron to hop up to a higher atomic energy level. The electron would then fall back to its ground state, releasing a photon. But since the atom is already traveling at near light speed, the photon's wavelength would be squeezed greatly, increasing its energy. Let me drop.
WA2VDH with a comment.
Okay, comment away.
Depending on the, I guess, the state of ionization, whether one electron or two electrons remain, that's going to have an effect on the force of acceleration on those ions, isn't it?
Yes, it will decrease them a bit because their total electric charge will be decreased, and so their acceleration through the electromagnetic accelerator will be slightly diminished.
So doesn't that mean that then their accelerating field is automatically going to select the ones that can be accelerated, because if, say, an atom that was doubly ionized or triply ionized, it won't get the same acceleration. It might spiral out of the accelerating field. So their accelerating field actually performs a kind of selection of which atoms are going to be, which ions are going to be accelerated, I guess.
Well, according to the paper, they were able to keep it going for hours, so they must have figured a way around that. As long as you limit the amount of totally naked nuclei, then I would imagine you don't have a problem, and that's what they seem to have done. They were able to tweak the equipment such that they could keep one electron circling the nucleus of a lead atom.
I see. Okay, thanks. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Scientists at the LHC are often trying new things. Last year, they accelerated xenon nuclei instead of the usual lead. The experiment is also receiving an upgrade that will let physicists gather more data faster. It will take many more experiments like these to unravel the mysteries of particle physics. Let me drop for any additional questions or comments. Okay, here's a lighthearted one. Statistics are like any man-made tool. With a hammer, you can build a house to shelter and protect your family, or you can use it to dent in the skull of a neighbor. This next story suggests how you might use statistics as a blender to turn your brains into the equivalent of a frozen daiquiri. Reported UFO sightings have been declining in the United States for the last few years, according to statisticians tasked with making sense of all the data acquired by leading civilian UFO investigation groups. The Mutual UFO Network is a nonprofit organization that investigates reports of the UFO sightings. The group encourages people who have close encounters to report their sightings on the Mutual UFO Network site. The organization claims it receives about 7,000 reports per month, but numbers have been on a steady decline since around 2012. There definitely has been a fall-off of late, Mutual UFO Network statistician David C. Court replied. It hasn't been a straight line, but in looking at these numbers, it was a peak in 2012, and it's been a 30 to 40% drop from 2012 to 2017. Let me drop. Quartz is a retired statistician who is currently studying the data to learn more about UFO sightings, like where they occur the most and how they're changing over time. Quartz isn't the only one who has noticed the shift. Cheryl Costa, a writer who was named International UFO Congress's 2018 Researcher of the Year, recently reviewed reported sighting data from both the Mutual UFO Network and the National UFO Reporting Center over the last 17 years and reported her findings in the Syracuse New Times. Her analysis shows that after a steady increase in sighting reported from 2001 to 2012, the reports have been on a steady decline. While both the Mutual UFO Network and the National UFO Reporting Center take online reports of sightings, the Mutual UFO Network field investigators examine reports and attempt to filter out hoaxes, mistakes, and objects that can be identified, according to Quartz. Let me drop. According to Quartz, Mutual UFO Network ends up clearing out about half the reports that people submit. I work with a highly filtered, highly clean data set, Quartz explained. With this data set, he hopes to see how certain UFO shapes like saucers and triangles and colors have increased or decreased over time, and he wants to find which areas have more or less sightings after adjusting for factors like population and area size. But one thing is already very apparent. Fewer people are reporting sightings. At this point, it's unclear. It's perplexing, he said. I don't know why it is. I think it's an interesting question. That's the kind of thing you discover by doing this kind of work. This is a curious trend, given that almost every other aspect of our world is better documented than ever before. More people are carrying cameras on them, and more people have access to the Internet and can therefore share their strange observations. Meteoric fireballs, for instance, are extensively documented these days, captured on dashboard cams, security, and phone cameras. So why not UFOs, the article asks. Let me drop. Sharon Hill, a geologist and science writer who researches pseudoscience and paranormal culture, has some ideas about why there have been a decline in reports. She says, in today's social media culture, the way you express your odd experiences is with some sort of video on YouTube or a picture, and UFOs are really difficult to photograph, Hill told reporters. It's not to say that there aren't weird things in the sky, because I really think that there are identified things in the sky, Hill said. Atmospheric anomalies, I think, are something that we probably should be looking into. But when people are interpreting these things as intelligent craft or physical objects that are examining us, that's a dead end. It's something that can be that can't be scientifically investigated. Hill also believes that culture around alien investigations have shifted to the focus of exopolitical conspiracies, that is, alleged attempts by governments to suppress information about extraterrestrial visitors instead of what's in the sky. Ideas about conspiracy have just infiltrated and warped the idea of investigating UFOs. Let me drop. You aren't able to investigate those things if there are conspiracies. Perhaps all the cuckoos are presently too busy hunting down QAnon rumors. I don't know. But the Mutual UFO Network says it's still committed to figuring out the truth behind UFOs. We're not alone in the universe, and there is intelligent life visiting us. Mutual UFO Network Executive Director Jan Harzen told reporters. He said that the Mutual UFO Network shares the data so researchers can better understand UFO phenomena. Let me drop for any possible questions or comments. Okay, Doc. I got another lighthearted one for you guys, if you're tolerating it. And now, for you guys that always wanted to be space cadets since the 1950s, you might be able to accomplish this childhood dream in only two more years. Vice President Pence laid out an ambitious plan a few weeks ago that would begin creating a military command dedicated to space and establish a space force as the sixth branch of the U.S. military as soon as 2020, the first since the Air Force was formed shortly after World War II. Pence warned of the advantages that potential adversaries are making and issued what amounts to a call to arms to preserve our military dominance in space. Just as we've done in ages past, the United States will meet the emerging threats on this new battlefield, he said in a speech at the Pentagon. The time has come to establish the United States Space Force. Let me drop. But the monumental task of starting up a new military department, which would require approval by Congress that shelved the idea just last year, may require significant new spending and a reorganization of the largest bureaucracy in the world. And the idea has already run into fierce opposition inside and outside the Pentagon, particularly from the Air Force, which could lose some of its responsibilities. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said last year that he opposed the new Department of the Military at this time when we are focused on reducing overhead and integrating joint warfighting functions. This week, last week, Mattis said that Pentagon and the White House are in complete alignment on the need to view space as a warfighting domain, but he stopped a bit short of endorsing a full-fledged space force. Let me drop. In a briefing with reporters after Pence's speech, Deputy Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan suggested that Mattis's comments opposing the Space Force were made at a different time, before the Pentagon received a bolstered budget. White House officials have been working with national security leaders to aggressively move ahead without Congress. The first step is creating a new U.S. Space Command by the end of the year, which could be led by a four-star general, the way the Pentagon Indo-Pacific Command oversees those regions. The new command would pull space experts from across the armed services, and there would be a separate acquisition office dedicated to buying satellites and developing new technologies to help the military win wars in space. After the announcement a few weeks ago, the president tweeted, "Space Force all the way." Let me drop. For months, the president has been calling for a Space Force, a new freestanding military department with its own chain of command and uniforms. In a letter to supporters a few weeks ago, the president's 2020 campaign said it would sell a line of gear that would come with a logo of their choosing, including one labeled Mars Awaits to commemorate President Trump's new Space Force. According to a copy of the email, a move that fueled criticism that the effort was motivated perhaps by politics. The White House has pushed Congress to invest an additional $8 billion in national security space systems over the next 5 years. After Pence's speech, Representatives Mike D. Rogers and Jim Cooper, members of the House Armed Services Committee, praised the move, saying a Space Force will result in a safer, stronger America. Let me drop. We have been warning for years of the need to protect our space assets and to develop more capable space systems, they said in a joint statement. In his speech, Pence urged the audience to support the administration's effort to create this department. The only thing we can't afford is inaction. Let me drop for any questions or comments.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Well, anything like that would be redundant. You know, they have plenty of money. The budget for NASA is roughly $20 billion, and then the budget for the military space budget, which involves the Air Force and the NRO, National Reconnaissance Offices, you know, all these different agencies that need access to space. They're up to $40 billion, so twice the NASA budget. So that's already accounted for, and I think any other organization would be redundant. But I wonder if that's the speech where Mike Pence was talking about the speed of the hypersonic development that would have missiles on it from China. Is that the same speech or a different one?
I believe that was the same one. Actually, he packed a lot of different things into that speech. He also talked about the delays in the highly secure GPS satellites that have been about 4 years late from scheduling. So he had a busy talk in the Pentagon that day.
Yeah, okay. In that speech, you know, what... Yeah, I sat through part of it, not the whole speech, but he did come out with that China has these hypersonic missiles that can come over the horizon, and they would be traveling at 5 miles per second, you know, which is not true. That's orbital speed. 5 miles per second is roughly 17,500 miles an hour. These things that come over at hypersonic speeds, the wave rider, things we've developed. They're in the, you know, 6 or maybe 7 times the speed of sound. So, you know, you're talking about much less, you know, the speed is much less than that. You know, so, you know, the facts that they come out with are really strange. They're talking about China hitting another satellite like it happened last week. This was years ago that they shot down one of their own satellites just as a test. That was kind of strange. But no, none of the reporters questioned that. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, unfortunately, politicians tend to not understand the underlying physics. And we live in interesting times where some guy's quote of truth is not truth, which I think he made sometime today on a news program, is probably going to end up on a T-shirt. But, you know, what can you do? Yeah, I think it's a bureaucratic nightmare. It's basically moving a bunch of tin soldiers from one pile to another and making it as expensive as possible and basically just designing new uniforms and lapels and such. So I think it's going to go the way of the military parade that was supposed to go on in November. So, okay. It was a relatively harmless, although very militant kind of presentation. It probably, in its final form, might have even violated some peace treaties we have in space.
Yeah, I think it's, what, 1967 or 68, they had the arms treaty. All these different countries got together and signed it. You know, you couldn't bring up a revolver legally, you know, and I mean, the Russians did it because they actually bought up handguns because, and not to shoot each other in space, but in case they landed in the woods somewhere, you know, out in the middle of nowhere, and, you know, some wild animal is going to come and get them while we're actually being ready for rescue. And that did happen. They did land in the middle of nowhere for a couple of days during one flight. But outside of that, you know, there's a treaty that says, you know, space is going to be utilized, and just like the moon, just like Antarctica, you know, you're not supposed to go down to Antarctica with heavy artillery back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is a lot of these guys don't read the small print. And going back to the Russians, not only were they carrying, but as I reported a couple of months ago, they're training their robots to carry weapons as well. So I don't know what to make of it. It was a relatively light point in the news. Otherwise, the news can get rather depressing.
Okay, I can cut. Yeah, the regular news, I'll fall asleep during. But when they start talking about, you know, something like that, then I'll wake up. To me, that's the exciting news. But very good. I'm glad you brought it up. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Back in the early days of telecommunications, engineers, which Dick knows very well, devised a clever way to send multiple telephone calls through a single wire at the same time. They called it time division multiplexing, and this device rapidly switches between sending pieces of each message back and forth. New research from Duke University shows that neurons in the brain may be capable of a similar strategy. In an experiment examining how monkeys respond to sound, a team of neuroscientists and statisticians found that a single neuron can encode information from two different sounds by switching between the signals associated with one sound and the signals associated with the other. They found that there are periods of time when a given neuron responds to one stimuli and other periods of time when it responds to the other. They seem to be able to alternate between each one. Let me drop. The results may explain how the brain processes complex information from the world around us and may also provide insight into some of our perceptual and cognitive limitations. The results appeared in the July 13th issue of Nature Communications. Most studies of a single neuron behavior investigate only one stimulus at a time, looking at how an individual neuron responds when the subject is played a single note or shown a single image. But reality is rarely so simple. Our brains are capable of processing multiple stimuli at once, such as listening to a friend at a party with music playing in the background, or picking out the buzz of cicada from a symphony of trilling insects. To complicate matters, single neuron studies have shown that many sensory neurons are broadly tuned, meaning that each is capable of responding to sounds at a range of different frequencies. For example, the same neuron triggered by your friend's voice may also be triggered by your notes of your favorite tune. Let me drop.
Wait.
Yes?
Have you ever noticed a student in the crowd learning some stuff and not being able to switch off so the music, people around, doesn't disturb them? Attention.
Yes, there are some people who are very good at separating different sound sources in a crowded, noisy room. There are other people who are less able to do that, especially when people have to fall back to hearing aids. A lot of the discrimination is kind of ruined as it goes through a hearing aid. But that's one of the things that they're posing questions of, exactly what's going on in our brains when we're differentiating those different audio signals that are coming in close to the same frequency.
I can do it. I've noticed it many times ago that I could do it. But the interesting is that the impulse that would stimulate me to switch back was either touch of me or any other impulse that was rapidly differing from just a regular crowd. Could you explain that?
I really wish I could, but we know so little about the minds in general and the human mind in particular that we're just kind of scratching the very, very surface. There's a lot of complicated, both conscious and unconscious things going on under each of our skulls. And we're getting cross messages and multiple transmissions along nearby lines, so that some things can produce odors, can kind of reactivate memories. Proust wrote a little bit of a book about that, and there's all kinds of other triggers. So I'm not surprised that there are triggers that disrupt your ability to focus in on a conversation in a crowded room. It's one of the aspects of the crazy way that our brain works.
My concern was, isn't that that when you switch off, now the brain is, I believe plenty of people can do it. You're in a restaurant and you can learn a lot from whatever you're reading or you concentrated on. The thing is that the impulse to switch on, the best that worked for me was touching me. So isn't that that the brain is switching to more drastic impulses or more drastic forms of attention needed in order to come back? Attention.
That might be what's going on. It's difficult to say. You're one example. I don't recall hearing too much about tactile stimulation affecting it one way or the other. There are a lot of people who can discern voices, especially here on the radio. I'm sure a lot of guys who spent a lot of time with static and QRM in the background, and they're able to tease intelligibility out of a signal that a lot of other people would just kind of shrug their shoulders. So it's a great indication of the processing power of our brains, but we don't really know that much about it. We're just scratching the surface.
G2RY.
Yes, David.
You know, what you're talking about makes me think of, like, when you're in a room, there are people talking, there are people interacting, and you're sort of in the background, you know, reacting to them by playing music, you know, that the room definitely has an effect on the music that you play. And it's sort of like maybe when you're playing in a band or with a group of people and, you know, one instrument interact with the other one, you know. I don't know if this is exactly what you're talking about, but this is what you're saying. It makes me think about that. Go ahead.
Okay, it's not really what I'm talking about. What I'm really getting to the gist of is that most people who know things about nerve cells think of them as one-way roads. You know, you get a stimulus, it runs down the neuron, and then it fires at the end, and then it's hooked up to another one. In this experiment, it suggests that there this temporal multiplexing, the same way that a DMR radio works slicing time, our very brains are capable of slicing time and sending disparate signals down the neuron, which I don't know, I find amazing, and it kind of resonates with some of the conversations we've had in the past here about electronics, because time domain multiplexing is a big thing with a lot of people. Yes, Eric.
As you know, I don't hear anything over the current, but yet I can equalize the room pretty good up to the top. And I'm just wondering if any of the stimulus that they've actually tried takes into account. Where I can kind of discriminate stuff based on its harmonic relationship or its phase relationship to one another, and it kind of it stands out in your mind. It separates it from all the rest of the background. And there's different kinds of stimulus like that that I think plays a role in how the messages get sent up along the neurons. And not only in terms of when you're saying like time delay and multiplexing, that sort of sense, and I kind of feel like it is, you know, the phase relationship, which is in the time domain. So it's an interesting thought.
Hey, Roy, what about lack of stimulus? Like, when you meditate, it seems like time just doesn't even exist.
Well, yeah, I mean, we could go into a long-running thing about the strangeness of the human brain. Our time sense is very, very poor. We're not really designed to be like clocks. We judge time by all kinds of secondary environmental factors. If you're having fun, time seems to speed up. If you're bored, time tends to slow down. This is not really what's going on with time or relativity. It's just your own personal perception. So, you know, you could go into this entire thing about how every human being is actually reconstructing a model of their own reality or their own perception of a reality inside them that actually has something like a 100, 200 millisecond delay and all kinds of limitations that we're not aware of, because we really have been wired not to think that this is a model, but we're actually experiencing the world in our brains. So you could go wacko. You could go very philosophical. You could go very clinical. There's a lot of different ways. And getting back to Eric, I agree that the phase relationships are an important aspect of sensory nerve detection, but I think they're trying to get at a more fundamental underlying concept of how nerve cells themselves can operate slicing time in addition to phase relationship calibration and observations.
Like language.
Yeah, what about language?
Just the interesting aspect of, you know, getting a signal from a cochlea, down a single nerve fiber, and the chemistry, or rather the electrochemistry that it takes to get to the point where it's going to affect something. I mean, that's just kind of like mind-boggling to begin with.
Yes, and it boggles the mind the way the mind boggles us. It's very deep. It's very complex. My guess would be we don't have much of a clue. We have a vague sense of the general gross anatomy of what locations do what things. We have a vague idea of how neurons sort of work, but this study shows that they time multiplex as well, so we haven't quite figured that out very well. So there's an incredible amount of stuff that we don't have the faintest clue of, and it's sort of amazing that we're using the organ itself to figure itself out.
Oh, well, we learn things in time, but I mean, look at what we're doing with DNA at a molecular level. I mean, that's just as crazy as even thinking about how things work in the body that we're not quite sure of. Oh, well, HC2GS, K2J.
Okay, AC2GS. Yes, genetics, genetic engineering is going to be an interesting field. As time goes on and we figure out more and more things that we can do, I think someone somewhere sometime is actually going to try to do everything. You know, it's the old thing of why do they rob banks? Because that's where the money is. And why do people climb high mountains? Because they're there. Anyway, let me go back to this rest of this article, and then we'll kind of call it a night. Let me drop for a sec. Yes, David?
I just thought how to say, I forget what I wanted to say. I'm sorry, I got distracted.
Okay, so I'll go on. Okay, David?
QSL. I still can't think of what I wanted to say.
Okay. Anyway, in the experiment, the researchers sat monkeys in a darkened room and trained them to look